Hi, I'm Nicole.
And I'm Monica.
And we're two fangirls who like to talk about media and knit. This is our podcast, While We Were Knitting. This month, we watched Dune, the 2021 movie. It's based on the first half of the first book of the Dune series, written by Frank Herbert in 1965. It's hard to summarize the plot of either the book or the movie, but at the highest level, it's a sci-fi chosen one narrative about Paul Atreides, the son of a duke and a space nun witch. Their family is assigned to the planet Arrakis, aka Dune, by the Emperor. Shortly after, Paul's father is killed, and Paul and his mother flee into the desert and join the native people of Arrakis, the Fremen. An important note is that we'll be discussing the whole Dune series, not just what's in the movie, so spoiler warning up front. So this month, in the knitting category, I knit Underwing Mitts by Erica Hessler. That's how I think I'm going to pronounce that.
I knit the Worm by Katushka.
Yeah. I also tried to knit the World's Simplest Mittens by Tin Can Knits, but we'll get into why that didn't work. So interestingly, Monica, I saw the movie on my TV at home via streaming. And then I was like, I need to see this big. I need to see this on a large, like movie-sized theater screen.
So you know, I almost did the same thing. The only reason I didn't was because just due to timing, the showing that I wanted to go to ended up being sold out, surprisingly, considering how long it's been in the theater. But yeah, because I actually thought about going to it in the theater first and then watching it on the small screen. But then I was like, wait, that's not fair. Then the knitting doesn't quite work. So I watched it on the small screen first. But yes, it seemed like the kind of epic thing that might benefit from being on the big screen.
Yeah, no, I went to the theater and I haven't been to the theater for 2 years because COVID, and I knit a little bit during the previews, and I was actually knitting The World's Simplest Mittens by Tin Can Knits because Underwing mm-hmm. Mitts is a color work, and I'm like, I know that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, oh, I can, you know, just try it with a simpler mitten pattern for the mitten drive that one of the local yarn stores is having. And during the previews, it was fine. There was enough light that I could see what I was doing. I could count the rows. And then we hit the actual movie and I was like, mm-hmm. oh, I can't. I have no mm-hmm. idea what's going on. So I like just was like, all right, I guess I'm going to put my knitting down and I'm going to just watch it without my knitting in hand. It was definitely very enjoyable in theaters though. Surprisingly yeah. crowded, like you said. I went to see a matinee at like 3:30 on like a Saturday. And I was like, oh, it's been out for, you know, about a month now. Probably won't be a lot of people. And I would say the theater was about half full.
I am glad that people are going to see it because, you know, yes, it's weird, but yes, anyway, later. But I am glad that people are getting back into the theaters. My favorite thing to knit when I was, because I knit in the theater all the time mm-hmm. when I used to go to movies a lot more. And my favorite thing to knit in the theater was typically either like stockinette hats mm-hmm. or the stockinette portion of sweaters in the round mm-hmm. which normally worked really well yeah. except sometimes when I got really really involved and realized, oh whoops, about 2 inches ago there was supposed to be waist chaming, which obviously you cannot do in the middle of a dark theater.
I am almost surprised, like you said, it's a weird movie, but the movie yeah. in a lot of ways is less weird than the books.
Agreed.
It's been a long time since I read the books. I read them in like, I want to say the late 90s, early 2000s. And the first book of the series is the least weird, mm-hmm. but it's still pretty weird. And mm-hmm. I think it's actually to the movie's benefit. And I've been thinking about this a lot, that it's less weird. And it's like, we don't have time to get into this. Do you need to know what a mentat is? No, you don't need to know what a mentat is. We're not going to explain it to you. It's not important. If you are a fan of the series, you'll be like, oh, I could see that these two men are mentats because they have the same lip tattoo and they do mm-hmm. the like, weird filming of the eyes when they're doing their like human computing situation because they don't have computers because of the whole butlerian jihad 10,000 years ago. But they're like, you don't need to know that. You, mm-hmm. the audience member who has not read this book and does not want to sit down and read, you know, 8+ books of this novel, just don't worry about it. You don't need to know. And yeah, I did appreciate yeah. that. But do you think it's going to set up some difficulties in the second movie where it's like some of the stuff that was weird, you just didn't explain to us. So now they've backloaded a lot of the weird stuff.
I'm not sure because I remember, so you probably remember when the Lord of the Rings movies came out, and a lot of people were like, oh, thank God they got rid of like stuff like Tom Bombadil running through the theaters and singing, well, running through the forests and singing, whereas other people were like, oh, wait, but that was like my favorite part of the book. But I do think that when marketed towards a mass audience who is not going to want every single detail, they do have to judiciously trim.
Yeah.
Because as it was, Dune, the movie, I thought it was a good length, but if it had been any longer, it would have been too long, I think.
Yeah, no, it's definitely that. And I was thinking about it after I watched it 3 times. So I watched it. I went to the theater and I watched it. And then I came back home and I was like, all right, I want to watch it again. So, because I went to the theater just before it went off HBO Max. And I'm like, mm-hmm. I'm just going to sit down and watch it again with the subtitles so I can like pay attention to those. And I almost wish that it had been shorter or they had ended it earlier in the mm-hmm. plot mm-hmm. because it felt at kind of a weird point. And at what they're, you know, meeting the Fremen, because that's what mm-hmm. Paul's visions have been of Chani and like meeting the Fremen and joining the society. But at the same time, I almost felt like a more natural breakpoint would have been the death of the Duke and Paul and Lady Jessica going out into the desert and like getting away from their captors, but basically being stranded in this desert and then being like, what happens next? That almost felt like a more natural breakpoint, but I could see why they felt like they needed to pay off the spiritual foretelling that Paul is having.
Yeah. I think that would have been kind of like an Empire Strikes Back kind of mm-hmm. ending in a way. And I don't think they've built up enough loyalty yet that you can mm-hmm. end at a point like that and expect people to come back for the sequel.
That's fair.
Is the issue. Because you're right. There wouldn't have been like the emotional, everyone would have been like, well, what happened with the visions? Okay, yeah. I guess they're going off into the desert now. Whereas this, you're like, okay, they've met up with the friends. There's momentum to the plot, I guess.
Yeah. Speaking of just the Fremen, and I think just looking at this, you're like, okay. And this was one of the things I was trying to dive in and think about with myself. I'm like, is there any way to make this plot less of a white savior narrative?
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
Maybe if you would cast somebody who was not white as Paul Atreides, that might have helped a little bit, but it is still, that is the story. That is fundamentally the story of Dune. And I don't think that you could not tell that story and still have the plot of the book. You would be telling a very different book movie, and I don't know if you could get $200,000 to be like, this is my original space opera, which none of you have ever heard of. So I'm not sure that there's a way to do that. And the Dune books themselves start undercutting that plot, or undercutting the idea of like, not necessarily a white savior, because Frank Herbert was, you know, writing this in 1965 and he was mm-hmm. a white dude and was not like, I don't think that was kind of on his radar, but the idea of it's bad to have a chosen one and you should not follow a chosen one is something that gets undercut by the novel in books like 2-3 onward. Mm-hmm. But the first book is very much like a chosen one narrative, and you're not going to get as an audience that undercutting of like, actually it's bad to have a chosen one in this movie. And I don't even think you're probably going to get it in the same way in the second movie either. So it's kind of a weird tension that is happening between the transference from a longer book series to a shorter movie. And I don't know if there's a way to get around that.
I don't know where they're going. I can definitely see how that narrative started getting set up in the beginning, because yes, to that point, there definitely were parts, especially towards the end, where you're like, oh, Paul may not end up being such a good guy at the end of this. So I think that there is the possibility that we may end up in a situation where, yeah, he's the savior, but maybe not later on. I don't know. I think it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this was like one of the things that I was looking at Timothée Chalamet, and this, I didn't really hit me till like the second or third time through, where I was like, you're not giving me an emotion that I want from it. And I realized that I wanted Paul to look and feel like constantly afraid. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't want it to be like the top level emotion, but I wanted like this constant undercurrent of the future is coming for me and I am terrified of it. Mm-hmm. that Timothée Chalamet was not giving me. And I don't know if that was just not something that the director was telling him to do, but I was like, that's the emotion that I want from Paul Atreides, to be looking into the future and being like, I hate this. Because
he doesn't seem afraid. Yeah.
And I was like, he should be more afraid. I should spend the entire movie being like, oh, this in the book, he's like 15 when the novel starts. Mm. And I'm like, this teen should be terrified. And it might not be the note that he's expressing, but kind of the low level background feeling of he sees the future and he hates it and he doesn't want it. And there was a part in the movie where they have that little mouse and it's the foreshadowing. Mm. And I was like, oh, this has apparently been lurking in the back of my brain for 20 some odd years, because I was like, oh yeah, it's Paul Modib. He has to be foreshadowing that they're going to be Paul Modib. And I'm like, oh, that is not something the movie is telling me. Unfortunately, I just know that. I use my cell phone within my apartment like every other day. But for the last 20 years, my brain has held on, oh yes, he becomes Paul Modib, like the mouse, to like try and undercut the prophecy. I was just like, that's so upsetting that this is something that I've held on to and I just have no memory.
I kind of love that for you, but yes, it's the brain worms. You cannot escape the brain worms.
And one of the other things that I just remembered and had in my brain again for 20 some odd years, this was just before I even got into the like deep dive on the wiki, reacquainting myself with what had happened in the Dune universe, was that when they're fleeing from the destruction of their home, Lady Jessica is like, damn the Harkonnens, I'm so angry, like they've destroyed us, I vow vengeance against them. And Paul, who has received Mentat training, is like, actually, Baron Harkonnen is your father, FYI. And just like, that becomes a big plot point later in the series, because Jessica's daughter is still in the womb when she takes the water of life, and she becomes possessed by the ghost of her evil grandfather, Baron Harkonnen. So it becomes like, and that's another thing where I'm like, oh, you're going to have to explain the whole like ancestral memories part of the Bene Gesserit, because they just don't explain it in this movie. And again, that's a thing that they didn't have to, because it's not part of it, but it's a big plot point for the rest of the series. And it's like, that's going to be a weird one to explain. Good luck.
Obviously, Dune is, as you say, this 8-book series with all these, with all this history and with all these like little trailers. I am really wondering just how they're going to, because I'm almost certain they're going to trim a lot of these things out.
Yeah.
But they made Jessica pregnant, so clearly that's going to be a thing. Yeah. Also, I was like, this pregnant woman running, you know, this early pregnant woman running through the desert and getting like, you know, thrown out of a plane and et cetera. And really, is this okay? Very well. I knew she wasn't gonna, you know, heaven forbid, I knew she wasn't gonna miscarry, because that's just not part of the narrative. Mm-hmm. But I was like, maybe is that how they're gonna tie up this particular like loose end in the book? But then they wouldn't have bothered to mention it in the first place if that were the case.
And also the daughter, because of her possession by the evil ancestors, like becomes one of the main villains in books 2 and 3. If you were like, we're going to get rid of this plot point, then you have to come up with an entirely different plot for books 2 and 3.
Although didn't Baron Harkonnen isn't, I can't remember when he actually died in the.
He dies after the end of the first book, but because the Water of Life puts you in touch with your ancestral like memories.
Right.
He's like able to control Aaliyah, I think is the daughter's name.
Because he didn't die in this one.
He did not, no.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if maybe they're just going to keep him.
I mean, they might. But then there's the like, okay, Duncan Idaho dies. Duncan Idaho in the rest of the series continues to get resurrected through weird clone nonsense. And I'm like, are you going to get into the weird clone nonsense in the sequel? Because weird clone nonsense is like some integral parts of like books 2 to like books 8. You're just like wild. And I had never actually read books 7 and 8 because those are written by Frank Herbert's son with co-author. And apparently Duncan Idaho becomes, and I'm going to mispronounce this, I know all this unfortunate like weird knowledge that my brain has held on to for 20 years. I don't know how to pronounce anything, but Duncan.
No, Idaho, of course. Why would you?
So much. Duncan Idaho becomes the Kwisatz Haderach, basically through being resurrected as a clone like thousands of times at the end of the book. That's book 8, end of the book. They've defeated the weird machines who have come back. They've made their alliance with the humans who have come back from the scattering. No, I won't get into it. I won't get into it because it's not that important. But anyways, Duncan Idaho is in every single novel. He becomes the main character by the end of the series. Explain the weird clone stuff now.
Yeah, I don't know. There's also the question of, did they actually go into the rest of the books before they decided to produce this thing? I do wonder about sometimes when it comes to these big series.
Well, and I read an article where the director's like, I loved these books growing up. This is like a really formative text for me. It was so important mm-hmm. to me. So presumably he at least has read the other books. And I would assume, I actually have a friend whose job it is to like, mm-hmm. as part of her job, she does reading of books to like see if they would be good properties for adaptation to movies. And so somebody in the movie theater, in that movie studio, has probably read or at least read the Wikipedia article to be like, this is what happens. The Wikipedia articles are insane. If you want to lose like 4 hours, Wikipedia is extremely detailed on the Dune universe, has it all in there. You can learn about it. So somebody has engaged with this, and I'm like, how are you going to deal with this? How are you going to deal with these insane weird things?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure someone has engaged with it, but being engaged in it is not necessarily the same thing as movie adaptation, you yeah. know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. there are some, unless they're like planning to make it a 5 movie thing, which is possible, that is definitely a thing that yeah. has happened with many. But I don't think it has the kind of like appeal across ages that, say, Harry Potter did. I'm not sure they would be able to get away with that, to be perfectly honest.
Books 5 and 6 start getting into what I'm going to refer broadly to as weird mind control sex stuff. That's like genuinely just unfilmable.
Yeah.
Like when I was 12 or 13, this was like the first kind of on-page sex scenes I had ever read. And I was just like, oh, wow. Okay. All right. So like some of this I think is as written, I'm like, this is not going to be filmable. And the earlier books are in a lot of ways less weird because you don't have that same sort of build-up mythology and history. And you can skim over stuff like, why don't they have computers? And like, what is a mentat? And like, they very briefly mentioned in the movie, they were like, oh, the Bene Gesserit have been running for thousands of years, this breeding program, mm-hmm. but they don't emphasize it. And I was wondering as I watched it, I was like, would somebody who is not familiar with the text of this movie realize that Lady Jessica is herself a product of this program, that the head of the order is a product of this program, that it's not just that Paul is a product of this master plan. It's like, no, this has literally been influencing the entire order.
Yeah, probably not. Would be my guess, because it was very throwaway.
Yes. And I was like, oh, that's going to come into play as what happens when Lady Jessica starts accessing and her daughter/fetus starts accessing these ancestral memories. Just a weird book. And it also becomes like this big thing about how Paul is unexpected. Like that's in the book is something that I don't know if it made as much in the movie, where Paul was supposed to be a girl. And I mean, the movie does mention that, but Paul was supposed to be basically the mother of the Kazi Chodorak. And part of the book is like the rest of the Bene Gesserit being like kind of castigating Jessica for her pride. They were like, you thought you could produce this prophet who will see through time and space. And she's like, maybe it was a bad idea. I don't know. But yeah, that's not something that is really as emphasized in the movie. So.
Well, the head of the order did make a point of it, enough that it was fairly memorable.
Yes, but they don't talk about like what was the plan instead.
Yeah.
Which, and again, is not necessarily something that would have benefited the movie in any way, shape, or form. So I can see why they were just like, we're just going to toss that throwaway line and we'll loop back to it in that second movie. Or presumably, I don't know. Maybe. We'll find out. Maybe. Yeah. Apparently haven't started shooting that second movie at all.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a choice. Oh, right. Yes. That thing.
So they started shooting in 2019 and they did all the shooting in 2019. And then they, I think, did the editing and the cutting and all that stuff.
I didn't realize that.
Yes. Yeah. So it's been 2 years since they finished. So presumably they're going to start up with, you know, the second movie, especially since, you know, both you and I had the experience of like, people are going out there to see this.
Yeah.
So we'll see. It's definitely interesting to think about how are they going to show that and how they're going to change that.
Yeah.
I did very much like one of the changes that they put in place for the movie where Dr. Liat Kynes is a woman. Mm-hmm. And I didn't remember that it was a man in the books.
I don't think I knew. Yeah. Yeah, I don't honestly remember.
Yeah, no, I didn't remember either until I was like in my back of my head, I was like, oh yeah, a man. And then I was surprised when she showed up because I didn't do a lot of pre-reading for the movie. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh, I guess they like caught me on my internalized sexism. And then I like read the Wikipedia entry and they're like, Dr. Liat Kynes, a man. And I was like, okay, kind of caught me on my internalized sexism, but also I was right to expect a man. That was what the books led me to believe.
I have a couple of friends who had not read the books who went to watch the movies. And they said that it seemed like a complete experience.
Okay.
So nothing about it seemed like they were, you know, you dive right in. That's kind of the way the movie goes. But they said that they did not feel like they were missing pieces that were necessary to understand the movie as it was.
I'm so glad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's actually really helpful to start with Chani as the narrator in a very Galadriel sense. In a lot of ways, this movie reminded me of Lord of the Rings, like you were saying, where they did trimming and stuff. And I think it's just, we haven't seen a really big speculative fiction property since Lord of the Rings, because the Marvel movies are very much about superheroes. They're not pulling as much from like a sci-fi fantasy tradition. Mm-hmm. And the Harry Potter are also like, I don't know, the Harry Potter movies do not feel like Lord of the Rings. No. This feels like Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, no, this feels epic. Yeah. And we haven't had that in a long time. I think there have been other properties that have tried to get there. And I watch all fantasy sci-fi movies. But the Star Wars movies, you can't really compare because that's such a, like, Star Wars is its own thing.
Yeah.
It's epic, but it's epic in a very like expected way.
Yeah.
Whereas this seems like an entirely new thing.
For sure. Can I just say that when Oscar Isaacs was like, I wanted to be a pilot when I grew up, I was like Poe? Like
Quite.
Yeah. No, that was a fun little, and I don't think they even intended that to be a thing, because this is not a movie. I enjoyed this movie a lot, but this is not a movie that had a sense of humor.
No, I don't remember laughing during it.
I did laugh when Jason Momoa made the joke about, you know, he was like, oh, you put on some muscle. And Paul's like, really? And he's like, no.
And he's like, no, yeah. No, you're right. That was cute.
It's also very, very funny how much of a different tone Jason Momoa had than everybody else. And yes, because everybody else was like declaiming. Like, yeah, that was the vibe. And Jason Momoa was just like, I'm just going to deliver my dialogue in a naturalistic setting, in a naturalistic way. Yeah. And it's also because I've only seen Timothy Chalamet in a couple of things, so I can't speak so much for him. But having watched Oscar Isaacs in Star Wars, I'm like, I know for a fact that you can deliver sci-fi expository dialogue in a naturalistic way. Like, it's not something that he's incapable of doing. So it must be a directorial choice to have this like declamation.
Ponderous.
Yes.
Everyone talked to like everything they were saying was very important all the time. Mm-hmm. And Justin Momoa was like, whatever. He also looked very different with his like face shape. Oh, yeah. I did not expect that at all.
And I was wondering, I can't remember. Oh, he went out with the Fremen. He had a beard before he went out with the Fremen. He had a beard when he first came back, and then he shaved.
Yeah.
And then he did it. He did it. Give me back this beard.
There were a number of faces that I was like, oh wait, you're a familiar face. Now I have no idea what any of their names are, but I'm like, oh, you're familiar too. I did not know that that his father was Poe up until you just mentioned it.
Yeah.
Like, you look super familiar, dude.
It's the beard. That was a great beard, by the way. I was just like sitting there and I was like, I've had a couple moments where my sisters and I are rereading the Harry Potter series and there's a strong emphasis where I feel much more one with the adults than I do with the kids, where I'm like, yeah, what are you guys doing? Like, so as part of my kind of emphasizing as an adult, it feels like a very adult thing to look at a man and be like, oh, he's got a little gray in his beard. Okay. I hear you. I see you. I'm very into what's going on here. And Oscar Isaac is 42. So he is.
Is he really?
Yeah. So you can, you know, see how he, especially five or however many years ago, when the Star Wars first started coming out, you could shift him into like his early 30s or his late 20s. And that was realistic. And how now he's got a little gray in his beard. You're like, yeah, he could be Timothée Chalamet's father, who even though Timothée Chalamet is 20 some odd years old, Timothée Chalamet also looks like he's approximately 12, which I'm not going to lie, was very uncomfortable for me with Call Me By Your Name. I was like, oh, I feel like I shouldn't be watching this. And then the whole movie became unfortunate for other reasons. But just even watching it at the time, I was just like, am I allowed to see this as a grown-up adult? Like, I'm just, don't arrest me. That was also very interesting. It was also like very funny. One of my friends said that Oscar Isaacs and I know her name, but I'm blanking on it, but the lady who played Lady Jessica, you look at the two of them and you're like, yeah, that could produce Timothée Chalamet. Like that, it looks like these two people are the parents to this human. That makes sense.
Yes. Yes, but Lady Jessica looks like she's not that much older than him. Which is not true of the Baron.
no. And again, but he's not. He's just got that gray in his beard and it looks good on him.
Yeah, no, it looks great.
Yeah. There was also the part at the confrontation with the Baron and you're like, he's very naked.
Yes, like, oh my god. Like, I was like, there was definitely either some like judiciously placed undergarments or just some very judicious camera angles going on in there.
Well, apparently there's a thing and it sounds genuinely pretty awful, but like you can have like this weird sock thing to like put, if you are somebody with a penis and you want to cover your genitalia on screen, that like covers the parts that need to be covered but does not have the, you know, side part that a pair of underwear would have. And I know this because, and this is a fun tie-in, Alexander Skarsgård, who's Stellan Skarsgård's son, Stellan Skarsgård is playing the Baron in Arrakis, in Dune. And so he was like, I hate them. I don't wear them. I'm Swedish. We love to be naked. I just didn't wear it. I was just nude. He was in True Blood. And there were a couple of times where his character was naked and they were like, do you want this little sock thing? He's like, no, I'll just be nude.
So I knew about the existence of the sock thing because when I first moved to this country, my roommates decided to take me out to a midnight showing of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. The one where they had the show showing up on the screen and then the actors playing down below. I guess that is the thing with the Rocky Horror. And at the last, this was a style choice, but at the last 20 minutes of the show, all the actors came out completely freaking nude, pasties on the ladies and a thong and socks on the guys. That was it. That was how they did the end of the movie.
All right.
Well, yep. So I was aware of the existence of these things, but I never actually associated it as being like something used in real movies.
Yeah. No, that's apparently one of the options because they were definitely using some judicious camera angles to be like, we're not doing full frontal male nudity. But I was like, oh, he's just kind of sprawling out there.
On a chair, no less.
On a chair. This movie was, and part of it is I'm sure my own interests, but this movie was very interested in Oscar Isaac's body. And I was like, I too am very interested in Oscar Isaac's body in a way that there were, when Paul and Lady Jessica were in the desert undressing, like you never saw Lady Jessica take off to get into the still suit. They were like, here's Oscar Isaac. He is incredibly naked and just lounging in this chair. Please enjoy. And I was like, all right, it's a weird context, but I shall.
Yes, very weird context, but yes, absolutely. Yeah. They made a point of him being naked, which was appropriate for the scene, even though it was a creepy appropriate.
Yes. And this was one of those things that the director actually commented on and was not explicitly in the movie, and they didn't explain, give you an alternate explanation, is in the prequel books, which unfortunately I did read because they came out at the point where I was still like very much a completionist about my series. So when Frank Herbert's son started releasing the prequels, I read at least one, possibly two, after reading all six of the original series, which again, I was like 12, 13, and this is what I was just doing with my time, plowing through sci-fi novels. And one of the things that's part of the canon of the Dune series is that the Baron is sexually attracted to young boys and is like, yeah, it's pretty unfortunate and pretty gross. And the reason that he is in a chair and is because he had a child with the Bene Gesserit, which became Lady Jessica, because that's kind of what the Bene Gesserit do, and like they can pull the strings, but he was like very not into it. And the Bene Gesserit, who was Lady Jessica's mother, was also like, this is a horrible person, and I don't like anything that's happening here, including him. So basically like manipulated his body in such a way that it caused him to not be able to walk anymore. And I can see why the director was like, we're just not going to go down that route because it says uncomfortable things about like multiple fronts. And instead they just don't explain why he's, you know, unable to walk, which also is kind of a weird and kind of unfortunate thing, where the only person in this series that we've been shown so far who uses some sort of assisted mobility device is like the evil bad villain. And it's I wish that wasn't happening, but that's what they decided to do.
I don't think it's necessarily immediately obvious that that there is something wrong with his body other than age. I mean, obviously, like someone who knows the backstory would, but given that he can fly, I mean, yeah. No.
And I think that's probably just not going to be part of the book. As he said, the director was like, we decided not to go down the like sexual abuse of minors route. And I was like, you know, that's probably a good idea. Like,
good plan. Mm-hmm.
Good plan. Like, I don't think any of us would have really benefited from having that as be part of the movie. So there's no real reason that within canon besides, you know, getting older or whatever, but it's just unfortunate that you don't have anybody else who would be in a similar situation, whether because of age or some sort of accident or something, who is using an assisted mobility device who wasn't, you know, the bad guy.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
I think that there may also be the impression, given the, you know, they portray the world as being a pretty harsh one. Mm-hmm. And I think there may be some of the impression that, you know, he's older, infirm, or there's something wrong with him. And the only reason he has survived when other people might have not is because he's this like being of immense power.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Yeah. And there's that weird section where he's like bathing in like weird oil. And I was just sitting there and I was like, this is visually very interesting, but it's also very weird. One of the interesting things, and this is another one of those, I wonder how they're going to play it in the second movie, is that in the book, he has two nephews. He has Rabin, who is Dave Bautista in the first movie. Mm-hmm. And then he has somebody whose name I'm blanking on, who is Sting in the in the original movie that they made of this. And I was sitting there going, you know, they don't technically have to introduce a second nephew, but if they were, I would be very into the second nephew being one of the Skarsgård children.
That's fair. Yeah.
You got it's definitely Alexander. And then I think Peter is the other one who's in Hollywood. And I'm like, listen, they already look like him because he's their father. Not him.
It's true. Yes.
So I was just like rooting for it. I think both of them could do like weird, creepy evil really well. Fingers
crossed. Yeah. No, I'm sure Alexander Skarsgård could do creepy evil very well.
Yeah,
he is a favorite of my best friend, so I have seen many interviews with him despite having no interest whatsoever in watching True Blood.
Oh my god, no, I have loved Alexander Skarsgård since like 2008, so long-standing interest in that man. But just thinking about the movie and what it was inspiring and what I would be inspired to knit, there's actually a pattern by one of the designers that I like that has a whole Dune themed set of patterns. It's by Barbara Benson and it's called Golden Lion Throne and it's mosaic lace.
Ooh, okay. Wow. So,
yeah. And it's a very cool series of shawls that she's put together. She's predominantly a shawl designer and she does both lace and mosaic work. But I was looking at the pattern, which I own and I'm going to knit in the near future. And I was thinking about doing it, but I was like, this looks really complicated. And it's got two techniques that I've never done together. So I was like, I don't think it's going to be a good thing to knit during my viewing of this movie, especially the first time. So I decided not to do it. I decided to just work on the myths that I had in progress. But that was the one that I was like, you could just go on a whole tear of Dune inspired knitting through her designs.
I'm just looking at the pattern now. I have never seen mosaic and lace combined before, like in the same rows. That's super interesting.
Yeah. I really like her work. It's very interesting.
As to what I would have knit, I think inspired, I keep thinking about sand, because, sand. Yeah. And so I think since I am not going to be knitting a skin suit, I was thinking something like a balaclava. Yeah. Protective gear, essentially.
For sure.
And given that we may not have sand in Chicago, but we have considerable winter, yeah. I think that might be a good option.
Well, it was very funny. I was sitting in the movie theater wearing my little mask for being indoors in public. And I was like, this is the appropriate costume to be wearing while watching this movie. Like I should be in this mask while I watch all these people run around in a desert planet in this still suit. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I was thinking about was like, I have a little camelback that I actually need to buy a new bladder for. And I was like, the perfect viewing experience for Dune would be to wear a mask and to have a little camelback and just occasionally take the little tube and like slip it under your mask and take a sip and be like, I am having a very immersive Dune experience. So that was really what I wanted to be having on at that time.
There were definitely moments where they're like running out, like running around in the desert in their still suits. And I'm like, why do you not have your mask on? I mean, I understand we have to see the prettiness that is all of your faces. There is a mask there and it's dangling around your neck. And I'm not sure I would have thought that in the before time.
Like, actually, we all know about mask safety now. I guess that you're not following it. But the costuming for this movie was beautiful. Mm-hmm. We were talking about it in terms of epicness, in terms of just people sitting down and doing the costuming, doing the scenery and the world building and the music. Mm-hmm. The music was so good.
Mm-hmm. One of the friends who went and saw Dune said, she's not particularly musically inclined, but she was like, I expect to go into that movie and have a particular like riff from that movie still be stuck in my head at the end of it. And she said this before going, she's like, because if they're setting this up to be like a Lord of the Rings or a Star Wars or something like that, you need that musical catch to be iconic to the movie. And I'm like, you know what? That's a really good point. So it's something I was paying attention to while I was watching. And I don't know if it has the same kind of hook, but it definitely had appropriately epic style, music.
Yeah. And it was definitely very like the way that they used bagpipes was very interesting. Yeah. I was like, oh, that was like a minor key bagpipe, or I don't even know because I'm not very musically literate, but I was like, that is not how I expect bagpipes to sound. Mm-hmm. But it worked for what they were doing in that setting.
But yes, when there were the bagpipes, I was like, oh, is this supposed to be some kind of a core? No, just bagpipes. Okay. Just bagpipes. Yeah.
Well, it was interesting to think about the motifs of this movie, maybe not musically, but the bowl was a big motif. Mm-hmm. You see the bowl with the little statue. They're talking about it in terms of their grandfather and his father. And then you see the bowl again when Duke Leto bites down on the false tooth and then exhales the gas and the bull is like looking down on them. And by the third movie, you're kind of like, okay, I see the bull symbolism. You have hit me with the bull symbolism enough times that I have picked up on it. Mm-hmm. It is the symbolism of how like the Trini's self-sacrifice and drive for destruction. Gotcha. Cool.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, no, the bull was definitely a big thing, and which is funny because, none of them are like bullfighters, et cetera. This is all the story of his grandfather, but nope, there's the bull.
Constantly, you see the bull getting packed into the little boxes as they take it to the Dune, and you're like, all right, you've shown me this bowl, I get it. And it was, I think, also just speaking of animals, how do you deal with like the sandworm, and how do you want the sandworm to?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I liked it. I was like, okay, I'm okay with the sandworm being this particular portrayal of it.
Yeah, I was like, this does look like a penis, but I don't think there's any way to do it that it doesn't look like. I'm just like,
it's
just
a worm. I mean, yeah.
I'm like, it's fine.
Yeah.
But I liked the teeth.
Yeah, that is how I feel like that's how it was described, right? Like, as I can't remember for the life of me, but yeah, like the remoras, like the giant remora impression. And I was like, you know what? I get it. And it was appropriately huge.
Yeah. And that's really what you want, because it's less important that what exactly to me, at least, the worm looked like. And it's more important that you get this impression of like threat and scariness and power. This is just a very powerful being in terms of not only how it affects the extraction of natural resources and like causes, in a lot of ways, the colonization of this planet by exterior powers who want to take advantage of this, but also in terms of how the people who live here, the Fremen, are interacting with this big creature that has this huge effect on their life, and how they have both this spiritual connection of like, praise the creator that Leah Keynes gave, and with all that little speech, which again, I don't remember, but that kind of spiritual connection to the worm and the knife from the tooth of the worm, as well as the connection to riding them and like the power that gives you to be able to ride the sandworm and use it as transportation through this planet.
Right. Like being able to ride the sandworm, being able to like call the sandworm, distract the sandworm, make the sandworm go away, like not attract the sandworm. You know, they've got that down to a T.
Yeah. Well, one would hope after being on this planet thousands of years.
Yes, it is true. It is true. But like just the idea that, you know, it's the whole colonizer thing. They know all of this. The people who have been coming, no idea, not a clue. Nope. They get eaten by the sandworm.
Well, there was the very interesting portion where the House Atreides is coming in and is saying, and they're talking with Duncan Idaho, and he's like, yeah, there's like millions of people, at least a million people on this planet. And they're talking about how the Harkonnens said there was like maybe 10,000 people. And I didn't think of it at the time, but one of the interesting things, at least in my lifetime, has been in like the early to mid aughts, it started populating in the popular understanding of pre-colonized America, how there were like millions and millions of people that were there and just basically died due to various infections and like colonization and genocide, and how that was a much, much bigger number than people had previously thought. And that's what it's just making me think of now, is kind of that parallel of, we don't understand this place and we don't understand who lives here.
Yeah.
It was also very interesting in terms of like parallels to colonization with how the Bene Gesserit had sent their agents or other Bene Gesserit to propagate this religion of the Lisan al-Gerhib. And on one hand, it's like very much a propaganda tool. It's like, we are seeding the planet with this myth to help anybody who might be there who is of our people. But it is also, in a lot of ways, kind of what they believe. Mm-hmm. Like the Kazi Terdaat, blah, blah, blah. Can I say that? No, I can't. But the Kazi Terdaat and the Lisan al-Gerhib, like, it's kind of very overlapping philosophical modes and philosophical stories. And it reminded me in a lot of ways of like how the Portuguese and Spanish colonial projects used Catholicism, where it's not like the people who were preaching Catholicism, the priests and the missionaries and stuff, didn't not believe in Catholicism. They were obviously Catholics, but they were also using it as very explicitly a tool of control. So
we have similar things like that in the Philippines, where, for example, if you are, you know, if a Manananggal, which is a sort of a Filipino vampire, comes to your house, there are several ways to destroy it. Number one is to throw holy water on it, which obviously is the Catholic version. The other way is to sprinkle salt on half of its body, which is obviously very much not a Catholic thing. So you see, I sort of very much saw the combination of, okay, this is the religion that we are trying to pose on you, but we're going to make it work with our religion and kind of blend the two ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things I just kind of thinking of that blending of ideas, and they didn't get into it in this movie, and I wonder if they're going to in the next one, is that there are women in Fremen society who are basically have the same powers as the Bene Gesserit. And that's when they were like, oh, we understand Jessica. She's a weirding woman. Mm-hmm. We have these people who are doing this thing and understanding that. And that was just not something that they really, I assume they're going to get into because they've already kind of set it up.
I mean, they're almost certainly going to get into it because that it made like that, it made it that point of, oh, okay, I guess we're not going to kill you after all, because you're a person and we get you now, you know, whereas before she wasn't, she was another, you know.
Yes. And she was also not only a person, she's a person with specific powers that we understand to be useful to our survival in a place where survival is very, very difficult.
Yes.
Yeah.
The spitting scene. I was like, oh, yeah, that's.
Yeah, these are two very different cultures that have a very different understanding of what just happened. And the entire time, Gurney Hall, like, every time he talked, I was just like, you need to chill. Like, you extremely need to chill, because like Duke Leto is like not asking you to do this. You are more protective of him than like you need to be. And that is making all of your lives more difficult, in fact. I haven't read the books because I didn't put it on hold. There are so many holds on books in the Chicago Public Library right now, by the way. There's like 100 and some odd holds on 40 some odd books for the first June book.
But you know what? That means people are reading, and that makes me happy.
They are. They're very much reading it. There's holds on every single version, including the ebook, the audiobook, the large print version, and the paperback. So every single version is booked from the library. And I wasn't able to go in and read it and see if there was as much emphasis on the alliance between the House of Atreides and the Fremen in the books as there was in the movies, because that in certain ways felt like a very explicit way that the director and the people making this movie were trying to emphasize the quality between these two groups of like both these people have something to offer, and like the Fremens are not just like savages from this like planet, and like trying to kind of step back from some of the like white savior implications and colonization implications. And I don't know how successful that but I was wondering if that was something that was as present in the books as it was in the movie. And yeah, unfortunately I can't say, because there's like 100 and some odd holds.
I suspect it was something, I mean I would not have, it was a long time ago and I read the books, I would not have noticed this at all, especially not as a, you know, teen, but I suspect it was something they specifically tried to make a point in the movie. Like the whole idea that, oh yeah, you know, this amazing technology that's keeping you safe, we didn't make that, they made that. They know how to handle these things. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember, and this is just something that happened back in like 2007, I was doing a lot of contra dancing, like folk dancing. And it's a very sweaty situation. And I was with a friend of mine who's doing contra dancing and is also a giant nerd. And he's like, you know what I think would be really great? Contra dancing in still suits. And that's just something that I was thinking about while I was watching. I'm like, yeah, contra dancing in still suits.
Yep, but all that sweat for good use.
Yeah, just a very different attitude towards water. It's interesting to think about this as being written in 1965, where a lot of the ecological kind of foretellings and rumblings of climate change like just weren't a thing. Like I don't like, there was obviously Dune, the novel is inspired by the dunes of the Northwest Pacific, which would like blow and like eat towns and eat roads, but it wasn't, I think, the same idea of like an entire planet facing ecological disaster in a way that we have to think about and that are very present today. So it was like interesting to have that with that different view from 1965 to 2021.
Because obviously the way Dune is presented, it's not presented as a world that was and then collapsed. It's presented as a world, this is always how it's been. Mm-hmm. And anything we have tried to impose on it has ended up going down. I think.
Well, there was the interesting exchange between Dr. Kynes and Paul when he's talking about, as emperor, I could reach out my hand and make Arrakis a paradise. And there was, I don't remember if where in the movie they said that, but they were like, oh, we were going to do terraforming to make this more hospitable to human life. And then the spice was discovered and nobody wanted to like endanger the spice. Mm-hmm. So there is, I think, the idea that like it is entirely possible to do that, but people have chosen not to improve the lives of the people who live here because they're more concerned about extracting from the world and less about the lives of the people who live here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why they go into that like underground basically laboratory and there are all those trees. And that's kind of the background. Mm-hmm. Dr. Leah Kynes is like, I think we could do this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then this is another weird thing where I'm like, I don't know if you're going to get into this because it's a couple of books into the future. This is books like, I want to say 3 through 4, maybe 3 through 5, where Paul's son, also named Leto after his father, basically takes a bunch of baby sandworms and puts them on his body and then starts becoming a giant sandworm. Like his body is encased within the sandworm and he becomes like a weird sandworm human. See, this is a weird series of novels. This is a weird series of novels, which is like why I'm like, I wonder if/how they're going to deal with it. And he, by becoming a giant sandworm human hybrid thing, is like basically terraforms Arrakis and like gets rid of most of the other sandworms.
Oh, you know what? I vaguely remember that.
Yeah. And he quote unquote marries his sister. He's like, don't worry, we're never going to have sex because I've become a weird human sandworm hybrid. This is a purely like for appearances marriage. Please continue onward with I think it's like the current emperor's grandson. Continue having children with him, have that relationship. This is just for the public. And I'm like, this is an insane series. This is an insane series. Just the like, let me become a human worm hybrid is an insane series. Anyways,
I'm reasonably sure none of that is going to happen. Reasonably sure.
Yeah, well, they did the mini series back in 2000 was The Children of Dune, and that was the one with God, I'm completely blanking. I know his name, Mr. Tumnus.
Oh, I don't remember. I don't know what his name is.
Yes.
Anyway. You know me and actors. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was Leto. And I think they ended it with him becoming a sandworm. I don't actually, I've never seen the miniseries, but that was like kind of the end of book 3. And then you time jump 5,000 years into the future for book 4, and then another 5,000 years into the future for books 5 and 6. And Duncan Idaho is in all of them as a resurrected weird clone thing.
I'm pretty sure that what they're trying to do in the movie series is that this is all going to be the story of Arrakis and Paul and that saga and like the inclusion of the Fremen. I'm pretty sure they're setting this up as kind of like a, you know, a Luke Skywalker kind of picture, I think. Well, that would be my impression.
Yeah. And the end of book 1 is Paul becomes emperor and he marries the daughter of the emperor as he proposed to Dr. Kynes. But he's like, but I will never sleep with you. So we'll have to have children through like artificial insemination, which apparently was very taboo in the future. And she's like, Bene Gesserit, because her mother is Bene Gesserit, the empress is Bene Gesserit, and she's trained all of her daughters, who she's only had daughters because her mother is Bene Gesserit, the way they work. And she's like, they're all like very scandalized, but they're like, I guess we have to accept this because otherwise we have no way to have this happen. And it's like a whole thing. And in the book, I had forgotten this, but the preface to every single chapter is from his future wife as like a sanitized biography where some things are true and some things are not. And then that's used to reflect upon the action. Yeah. Which again, some things are true and it's like, oh, this actually happened and some things are not. And you're like, oh, this is the little header is directly in conflict with what you're telling me in the chapter.
Which is interesting. I mean, that's the narrative, the way they propose it, like with the whole thing with him having these visions of, what's his name, Joshua? No, is that his name?
Jamis? Which, Jamis is the Fremen who he kills.
Yes, thank you. Yes. I don't know why I thought it was Joshua. Same J. But him having like those visions of that those conversations with him and et cetera. And then I was like, oh, okay. So maybe this is how it's going to go. And that's not how it went. Nope, not at all.
Not at all. And that was interesting in when you reflect upon the conversations he was having with the head of the Bene Gesserit, where she was like, do you have dreams worth the things you've dreamed come true?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Like, not exactly. And that's like kind of a weird thing because then one of the themes of the book is like very much Paul as the predecessor to Leto, and Leto being like kind of more in fulfillment of the prophecy of the Khazarij Haderach, because he can like see the future more accurately.
Leto his father, not Leto his father,
who is normal and can't see the future. And again, I don't know if they're going to like go down that path, because that's a very like, book two is about Paul becoming disillusioned with being the emperor and disillusioned with being the Khazarij Haderach, and basically renouncing it all and being like, it's bad to have a chosen one, and going into the desert. Yeah. That's the end of book two. And you're like, so are you doing that storyline?
No, I'm willing to bet that's not. I'm willing to bet that this series is going to end with him becoming emperor.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure that's how where that's going to go. Yeah.
And interestingly, in the book at least, they're like, yeah, we still had this horrible war and this genocide, but it was less worse than it could have been, because Paul took steps to make it less worse, but he couldn't stop it. Like the genocide that he's foreseeing in, and the holy war and the chaos that he's foreseeing in the movie still kind of happens.
Yeah.
And I'm interested to see if that's the path they go down with that one. What a time to be alive.
Quite. Yeah. I was like, what? Another Dune movie? Didn't we just have one? I guess it wasn't. Yeah.
Well, back in 2000, they did the miniseries.
Yes, it's true.
I think that it was a successful adaptation of the material they decided to cover.
Agreed. Yes, I think so too. And I think it was appropriately palatable to a wide enough audience that people are going to go watch the sequels.
Yeah. And I'm interested to see how weird they get with the sequel, because there's some stuff where I'm like, unless you're going massively off track, you are going to have to get weird. Well, of the two things that I knit, the underwing mitts were, I'm on the second mitt, so I think that was helpful. And I already kind of knew the plot of the movie, because I have memories of this book stashed in the back of my head. I've not reread it since.
You have ancestral memories.
I have ancestral memories. So it was like, okay, but if you were like, somebody who knows nothing about this, go in and knit these? I'd be like, no, don't do that. And I think it was generally a more enjoyable movie when I was in the theater and just not knitting. And when I came home and I had something in my hands, the world's simplest mittens were fine. And like, that was, you just had to like check in every couple rows to be like, am I done with the number of rows I need to do? So that was fine. But I would actually, this is, I think, a rare movie where I would say it might benefit from, at least for me, it benefited from not knitting, so I could give the entire movie my full attention. But I like, there are a lot of problems with this movie. I think I've mentioned kind of my biggest ones, but I saw it 3 times in a week, and I'm like, do I need to buy this movie on DVD for the director? I think I have to. So I had a lot of feelings. How did you feel about The Worm?
Ironically, considering the title, it worked perfectly for the movie. I think I would probably still like to watch it again in the theater. Mm-hmm. I will still knit in the theater anyway, but it has enough like little like drops that, as you say, kind of come and go, that I think I would benefit from a second watch with something just simple stopping it. But The Worm is basically a couple of rows of pearl, a couple of rows of knit, a couple of rows of pearl. So it was perfect for something completely mindless, and something that I knew I was going to want to pay attention to what was going on in the screen.
Yeah. Did you like the fight scenes? I know you're a fight scene condo.
I did like the fight scenes, but I did not find them memorable the same way I find like Marvel fight scenes. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. No.
I found things like the sandworm like to be a memorable visual. But the actual like people fighting people scenes, I was like, yeah, they're all right, but not memorable.
That's fair. Well, next month we will be watching something that hopefully we'll have from Marvel, many memorable fight scenes. We'll be watching Shang-Chi, that Marvel movie. And that will be exciting to compare and contrast and see kind of how two very different speculative fiction properties work. We will see you next month. Bye.
Bye.